I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold.
We're here on our 28th episode, and one thing has become very clear. In every interview we've had, the problems we face are far from straightforward. You know, we look behind the climate crisis and we find a broken economic system. We look behind the broken economic system and we see that it sits on a foundation of racism and other inequities. And it goes on and on.
Well, this is exactly what we're trying to do here, is to speak and highlight the hidden connections. And speaking to Osprey is so good because she is so good in doing this. So I'm very excited to share this interview with all of you. So Osprey is the founder and executive director of WECAN International. That stands for Women's Earth and Climate Action Network.
Working at the intersection of women's empowerment and climate justice, Osprey has a special way of parsing the complexities of our current moment and brings out the importance of centering women's leadership, especially the leadership of Indigenous women and women of color. Here's Osprey.
Hi, my name is Osprey Oreo Lake, and I'm the founder and executive director of the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network. And thank you so much for having me on your program. And just a little bit about our organization. Our acronym is WECAN. It's a climate-just-based organization that's established to unite women in worldwide movement building for social and ecological justice. And our primary work is with women globally on the front lines of the climate crisis, but in particular with Indigenous women, women of color, low-income women, and really underserved communities. But we also know that it's really important to have this effort be united with decision makers. So our network also engages with women at the highest levels of government and business. So, you know, that we can really have a dialogue between those on the front lines and those who are, you know, lawmakers and making decisions in communities. And we balance our educational work, our advocacy work, our trainings and policy and campaigning work and direct action with also bringing forward really important values that bring us closer to earth-respecting worldviews, traditional ecological knowledge, and you know, more personal and cultural awareness of living in harmony with nature, which reaches from everything around our relationship to the natural world, to our economics and lifestyle. So, you know, it's very wide-ranging work, but at the center and at the heartbeat is, you know, our understanding that if we're going to really impact and have an influence on our current institutionalized patriarchy and racial societies, racist societies, that we really need to lift up women's leadership.
What is most important to you? What got you involved in this work?
Well, you know, interesting for me, when I began to do this work was actually back in 2009, when the Obama administration had come into office and there were the big climate talks happening in Copenhagen. And I think a lot of us who've been involved in movement work were very excited that we had this new administration and that, you know, the governments were going to meet in Copenhagen and there was going to be a real push to resolve or take deeper action on the climate crisis. And, you know, long story short, that did not happen, as we know. And I was actually not involved directly in the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network at that point, hadn't been generated. And I just had, you know, this big sense, like of a lot of my colleagues, like this was a key point that we absolutely had to do something. And that's when our organization started. And I began to look at where there were nodes of influence that would be useful in helping to move the dial, as they say, on the climate crisis. And through a lot of my own research and research that women around the world have done for decades on feminist and feminist views, I found that there was a very strong link between not only the fact that due to unequal gender norms that women were being impacted first and worst by climate change, but on the flip side, that also women are absolutely central to solutions, and that was one of the untold stories of the climate crisis, is that women are doing all this work, and yet that story had not been really shared publicly. And of course, women's organizations are completely underfunded, and women face all kinds of a variety obstacles as they try to do their work. And just to give a little bit of a background, you know, as an example, you know, in the Global South, there's between, you know, at least between 40 to 80% of household food production is done by women. And so they're uniquely positioned to chart a more sustainable course through their daily work in food production. We know from our own program called Women for Forests, the leadership role of women being backbones of movements to protect forests from the Amazon to Alaska to where we work in the Democratic Republic of Congo. People are familiar with, you know, I think a very primary example is there's a longstanding tradition of women forest protectors in India. From the Chipko movement that goes back to the 1970s, where women were fighting to protect their forests from industrial logging and created the Chipko movement, which means to hug. And that's where we originally get that whole concept of, you know, tree huggers. It's actually from these women who put their bodies on the line to protect their forests. So around the world, we see women on the front lines of protecting and defending the Amazon rainforest. We're working with some wonderful Tlingit women in Alaska to protect the Tongass rainforest. Again, women are responsible for food production. We know from United Nations studies that when we see a lot of these increasing problems around water security and the need to really have access to water as droughts increase, that if you don't involve women in these issues and programs around water usage and water security, if you don't involve the women, the programs don't work because it's the women on the ground who are collecting the water every day for their families. So this role of women is absolutely essential. We saw here in the United States after Hurricane Katrina, there were so many African-American women and Black women who are disproportionately impacted by these kinds of disasters, really became visible as powerful leaders, generating desperately needed awareness and activism concerning the links between environmental and climate justice, racism, health, and economic disparity. And those leaders have gone on to, you know, run so many programs. A dear friend of mine, Jackie Patterson from the NAACP, is doing incredible work around racial and environmental justice and that connection. So there's just tremendous leadership that we're seeing from Indigenous women, Latinx women, and again here, you know, clearly I'm stating, you know, the role particularly of women of color at this time and how important it is to highlight their impact, which is both gender-based but also race-based, and how we really also need to center their voices at this time. But the role of women is becoming very, very clear that we actually cannot have sustainable economies and clear leadership without women stepping forward and for the rest of the world to really uplift that. And I'll just give one last example. We're here in the middle of this COVID-19 global pandemic, and study after study is showing that countries that are led by women are doing far better in terms of their response to the pandemic than countries led by men. And this is also true around climate issues and environmental issues, that when women are in the role of leadership, the statistics show us that there's a far better result about how women are leading their countries and their communities when it comes to the climate crisis as well.
So Osprey, when we stay with the example of that leadership in COVID, which is such a nice, obvious example, yeah, throughout Europe and actually the entire world, we can see that countries have been kind of dealing better with the virus when there was a women leadership, female leadership. So why do you think that is?
I think a really interesting point is that when you have any part of the human population that is oppressed, I think that those on the front line, those who are experiencing the pain the most, those that have suffered the most, also are also the key points of where the solutions arise, because that is where people are struggling and having to figure out how to survive and how to navigate. So I think this is true for women. We have lived in patriarchal societies for thousands of years, and women have been treated as second-class citizens and have had to navigate all kinds of manner of disenfranchisement. And as a result of that, you know, they have figured out, you know, survival mechanisms in different stress situations. So I think that lends to their capacity to understand leadership when more stresses come to their communities. So that's one component. Another component is due to the kinds of gender norms that are practiced, women are in fact, you know, the ones who are caring for their families. They're the ones caring for their children. They're the ones caring for the sick. They're the ones who are doing all of that unpaid labor that is everyday hard work. And so when it really comes to food, water, shelter, clothing, survival, women are the ones who are having to, again, navigate these extremes and difficult situations. And so they're the ones who have a lot of practical solutions to these matters. And as I was mentioning, a huge amount of food production and water stability is carried out by women around the world. So again, you know, in terms of leadership, there's a lot of practical knowledge from having to deal with these issues for a very long time. And then I think there's another component to this that is harder to put into statistical equations, but is very true, which is that women have a lot of social capital, and their capacity to be in relationship with their families and to have a emotional and spiritual strength that is, you know, whether we want to call it through biology or for cultural norms, I mean, that's a big conversation, but let's stay with the fact is at this point that I notice in a lot of our work, when we do delegations of bringing frontline women, Indigenous women as an example, to go meet with financial institutions to talk about what's happening to their territories due to fossil fuel extraction or fossil fuel infrastructure, or we bring delegations to the UN climate talks of frontline women, one of the things that has the most impact with those making decisions is hearing the stories from the women about directly what's happening in their families, the violations to their bodies, the violations to their health. These stories about these impacts that women are carrying and pushing an emotional agenda around, how we can be more human as we're talking about these life and death situations that are impacting us through both environmental crises and the climate crises, as well as now the COVID pandemic, are absolutely essential. Also, they can bring their emotional and spiritual intelligence to the conversation that I think is very, very important at this time. Or, you know, we heard these stories about the leadership of Jacquina Ardern and New Zealand, and people were really commenting on the fact that her ability to communicate the message and share compassion and share her heart really united everyone in New Zealand to follow the proper protocols around COVID. So I don't think we can dismiss this other factor that is harder to put your finger on, but ends up making us very human and makes us cut through a lot of the distant policy conversation that often takes up so much space in these decision-making situations.
Osprey, I'm often curious about the gender dichotomy, and I almost want to ask the opposite question from what Stephanie just asked, which is, why are men not as powerful in these kinds of leadership, and what is the perspective of your organization in terms of bringing men around or somehow empowering men to have a more kind of holistic, connected perspective to join the kind of work that you're doing?
Well, there are actually men who work in our organization, not that we're hiring men, but who are part of our larger network. And, what we like to say, it's not about putting men down, it's about lifting women up. And I think the role of men at this time is to understand that we have lived in these really imbalanced governance structures and patriarchal societies for quite some time. And the strongest role they can play is to help center women and to center women's voices and to listen to what women are saying and to practice step back and lift up. I'll give one really interesting example. We were supporting a big women's march and rally in Ecuador several years ago on International Women's Day. And it was women, again, who were putting their bodies on the line and leading out stopping, protesting against the destruction of the Amazon rainforest in Ecuador. And it was an incredible group of so many indigenous women leaders who came from regions all over the Amazon, taking 5-6 days to travel even to get into Puyo in Ecuador, which is the nearest city where they wanted to do their protest. And there were, several days of rallies and women speaking very powerfully about, getting oil companies out of their territories, protecting the Amazon, the need for there to be climate justice, to protect their traditional ways of life, to protect indigenous rights. Very, very powerful time of women being in ceremony together, singing, marching through the streets. And the men said, "What do you want us to do? Like, what are we supposed to do here?" And I watched how the women organized the men to set up all of the facilities, to run the media, to do all of the footwork that was needed to feed all of these women that had come for these gatherings. And it was just really powerful to see that and to see the men really enjoying the fact that there was things for them to do that really helped lift up the effort of the women. So just as an example. So there's that level. And then I think there's very deep work as we dismantle the patriarchy, just like we are all learning more and more about dismantling racism, that, this idea of white supremacy runs deep for all of us, but particularly with men when you couple that with patriarchy, and that this deep work of education and internal work is now equally important as we dismantle these structural inequalities in our system that are now, just blatantly in the open, that have been here for, hundreds and hundreds, in cases, thousands of years, and that there's a lot of internal work to do as well.
I want to ask move a little bit to the results. Like, what kind of results come out of the kind of work you're doing? And do you see any particular kind of work that you're doing that's more effective than other types? Like, what really kind of creates the biggest change and the biggest awareness that you know of?
Well, I would first say that I'm always a little hesitant to talk about like singular solutions, because I always find that really a variety of ideas are needed and solutions are needed, and that I look at it more like an ecosystem in nature, where you need all of the different, variety of plants and animals all operating together to have a healthy ecosystem, and every being within that ecosystem has its important role to play. So I just wanted to sort of frame, some of these things within a context that we know that we have to be very intersectional at this point. I think one of the things that has really been, exciting for us particularly is to do everything we can to uplift Indigenous women's leadership. I think that it's one of the most important things that we can do, because at this point, 80% of the biodiversity left on Earth is in the hands and lands of Indigenous peoples. And when we're talking about forest protection, and species protection, we really must center Indigenous peoples who have been living on their traditional lands for millennium and doing so in a good way. And though they're only about 4% of the world's population, 80% of the biodiversity in the region. And I think there's a lesson there that we need to hear loud and clear. So as an example, I've been very honored to partner with Michelle Cook. She is a Diné or Navajo Indigenous human rights attorney, and she has a program called Divest, Invest, Protect, and we partner with her on divestment campaigns and bringing Indigenous women to meet with financial institutions. And this was really birthed out of the Standing Rock movement and what to do after all that had happened there and all the incredible effort, which is a whole story unto itself. But anyways, there was a group of us, a delegation of us, who began to go meet with financial institutions, primarily in Europe at first, because they have a higher human rights standard, and meeting with their environmental sustainability governance officers of different banks, and to tell them again why Indigenous people did not give free, prior, informed consent, which is part of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, international law, that Indigenous people must give their consent before anything happens on their territories and lands. So there was a violation of those rights. And, you know, to speak to these, you know, bank representatives and insurance representatives from the companies who were funding the companies behind these different activities like the Dakota Access Pipeline, but other pipelines and fossil fuel extraction sites as well, and to really present the argument of divesting from these bad actors, and that these banks and these financial institutions should not be funding these companies that are causing human rights violations, Indigenous rights violations, and harming the environment and harming the climate. And having these women directly talk to these representatives is extraordinarily powerful strategy. One, giving voice and allowing, you know, giving space for these women to speak truth to power is very healing for them, having experienced violations themselves. And then also, there's nothing like face-to-face human contact when you hear people's stories. So again, these several of the women we brought were attorneys, and they are able to tell the legal component of these violations, but also then to hear the heart-to-heart story of what it feels like to be oppressed, what it's like to have your water attacked, your land attacked, your body attacked by the very companies that these financial institutions have invested in. And that we were able to get some very large divestments. Hundreds of millions of dollars were taken off the table. And so we know that that has an impact when you have these direct transformative conversations led by Indigenous women, led by their organizations, led by their knowledge and their power to communicate their own story.
Like when we see the facts, we are running out of time to put all what you just talked about basically in place to empower women. And what's the strategy within your network, including climate action, that is actually in your title. what's your strategy, Osprey, to pull forward sort of before, you know, before we sink?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's always, you know, the biggest question of all. You know, I could list off our programs very briefly, like the nodes that we think are most important, which I'll do, and then just sort of make a bigger comment about this moment. But one, you know, we need to shut down the fossil fuel industry, period. We need to get off of fossil fuels. You know, as an example, 33 banks have invested $1.9 trillion into the fossil fuel extraction since the Paris Climate Agreement. And I find this really appalling. You know, a majority of the world's governments agreed in 2015 to the Paris Agreement, and this is what we get, $1.9 trillion more dollars. We just need to look in the United States at the bailouts that are going on right now in the COVID crisis that are going to the fossil fuel industry. Outrageous. It's one of the biggest transfers of wealth that we've seen. Is the money going to the people? No. People are losing their homes, their jobs, their lives, and the money is going to bail out these industries. Outrageous. So, you know, I think we need to keep our eye on the ball on the fossil fuel industry, because without stopping, you know, carbon emissions in the atmosphere, we can't get anywhere. So that's one issue. We have a Women for Forests program. We really believe it's essential to protect biodiversity and forests. Here in the United States, the Trump administration is trying to roll back something called the 2001 Roadless Rule, which will open up old growth logging in, as an example, the Tongass Forest in Alaska, which houses about 8 to 10% of all of our carbon emissions through forests. So like, we can't let our forests go down. We also work in the Amazon, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, planting trees. So we feel that forests are key. Biodiversity is essential. Going after the fossil fuel industry, lifting up women's leadership, and really creating these feminist economics. You know, really, what are these new plans? We also have a very strong program around rights of nature, which is basically this idea that we need to move out of a property regime into understanding that nature has rights, water has rights, and that we need to have rights of nature be equal to human rights, that we can no longer see nature being a subset of the economy, but completely reverse that DNA and understand that, no, the economy must be a subset of the carrying capacity of the natural world.
It sounds like a huge message to go vote. Go vote.
And beyond, actually.
Yeah, of course. How can our listeners get directly involved in the work you're doing? What are your recommendations for specific actions that people can take that will make a difference?
Yeah, our organization, our website is wecan, and then the word international spelt out, wecaninternational.org. And folks can sign up for our newsletter and learn about what we're doing. We're ourselves doing a series of education and advocacy webinars in response to the multiple crises of COVID-19, a lot of the work around climate, as well as the intersection of what's been happening around racism and white supremacy in the United States. So this webinar series is connecting all of those issues, and people are welcome to join those. In terms of actions, vote, 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 vote. I mean, this year, I think that would be the one thing I would simply ask people to do is vote.
Awesome.
As a closing message, is there anything really close to your heart which you really would like to bring out to the world or to our listeners?
Yeah, I think in closing, again, I would like to bring attention, and I don't know if your audience is national or international, but I do want to bring attention to the fact of defending the land defenders. I think it's one of the things that often gets overlooked is that there are people every single day, and a lot of it is through women's leadership in the backbone of these movements, physically, literally putting their bodies on the line to protect their land, protect their water, to protect forests. And we know from the organization Global Witness that the increase of attacks on environmental land defenders is rising. And for women, it has many complexities because there's also sexual violence that they face, harm to their families. So it particularly hits women the hardest. But we must do everything we can to speak out for the land defenders. We must speak out for those who are protecting the water and the forest and the land and all of our natural resources for all of us that we depend on to survive, and never to forget them. And that their threats are increasing. And, you know, we see this a lot in the Global South. But also, let's face the fact, here in the United States, there's a lot of laws being instituted now in different states around criminalizing people for protesting for their communities and standing up for their free right to speech, or to stand up against, fossil fuel infrastructure in their communities. So all over the world, we're seeing, you know, as we have this power struggle taking place, the need to protect land defenders.
Thank you.
Fantastic interview, Osprey. Thank you so much.
You know, what was interesting about what Osprey is saying is that she's not bringing in a whole new force in the roles of caring for the earth. What she's saying is women are already caring for the earth. They're already managing the household resources. They're already purchasing the food and the material for the household. What she's really doing is connecting these women to leadership in political sense, you know, and giving them a voice, bringing forth their voice. And that's really cool, because that work is always happening, but it's kind of invisible. We're not seeing it. And by putting it at the forefront, suddenly we can see how powerful those voices are. And and perhaps even model our behavior after those voices.
And necessary to saving the planet. Those voices are absolutely necessary in saving our planet.
Yeah, what was the statistic? Like
80%.
So 4% of the world's population basically manages 80% of the world's biodiversity. I think that's what she said. That's really enormous. And most of those 4% are people that we've never heard of. We don't know who they are.
Yeah, I actually heard that 2% of the rainforest are currently sort of researched, and we know what's in there, and that's very, very lucrative for the farmer industry. And so imagine 2% only, how much more healing stuff is in a forest, you know, for our Western society. I mean, only that aspect, we would stop immediately chopping it down because it's too lucrative for us.
Yeah, I think of all the illustrations of eco-disaster, that vision of seeing tractors chop down the rainforest is really devastating for me emotionally. How could we do that? It's so unthinking.
I don't know if Norway came up in that in our discussion with her. Somehow it did, right? Somewhere in there, Norway came up. And I wanted to say it in the interview already, but Norway currently, as far as I know, is the only country who actually recognized that whatever is done in the south, especially to the rainforest, actually has an effect to the northern countries. So hence, they are donating and supporting projects down in the Amazon forest as a very rich, privileged country. No, they have oil, but they manage it very well. But then they also, you know, distribute their wealth within for their own population, which is pretty awesome, actually, how Norway does stuff. So imagine all of us caring for the others in that way. And I think our world would look very differently. Like if we in the United States would pay and help, not just give some aid, but actually really go and, you know, with knowledge and give knowledge and money.
Or not even go, just, you know, empower
give,
the people that
give
are
and
there.
Go.
I mean, and there are people with that kind of awareness, and As we become global citizens, like Evelyn, our very first guest on the show, we start to see these connections much more clearly. And I think that's what we're doing, is becoming aware of just how interdependent we are and how much we are responsible for supporting people we don't even see, plants we've never even noticed, and all the way across the globe. Because if we don't see ourselves as participants in that grand network, we're just destroying it.
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more, join us at potofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore. Thanks for listening.